This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about new recycling options proposed in the next McLean County 20-year solid waste plan developed by the Ecology Action Center.
We don't have good recovery processes, say, for multifamily housing recycling, even though those materials are perfectly recyclable.
Michael Brown is the executive director of the EAC. Municipal ordinances could require some types of recycling by 2022 if voluntary programs aren't effective. Get up to speed on the Toys for Tots Silver Ball fundraiser and the after party with the band Wildermore. And it's a conversation with Bloomington Normal radio legend Don Munson. He's announced his retirement and the end of his Thursday evening show, Radio Munson. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 7th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. How Bloomington Normal and McLean County handles its solid waste is changing. There's little choice. The McLean County landfill will close sometime next year. The proposed new 20-year solid waste management plan developed by the Ecology Action Center considers that change and others over the past two decades and looks ahead. The EAC developed the new plan, and McLean County, the City of Bloomington, and Town of Normal are expected to approve the plan in the next few months. It's being considered by the McLean County Land Use Committee, which holds a public hearing today with a public comment period ending January 4th. Michael Brown is the executive director of the Ecology Action Center. He says the plan represents 2 years of work with input from more than 100 people, but some are still asking for changes.
I think we're looking at really fairly minimal modifications that might need to be considered here. I think the gist of the plan, I think there's a lot of broad-based support for it. We've received a lot of positive feedback from a lot of different entities. Even people who are maybe critical of some aspects really liked the plan, you know, in its kind of the detail and the depth and the analysis of the needs of the community. And so I think there's just maybe some fine points that need refinement.
Discuss the process a little bit. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, over 2 years ago now, we first were looking at the need per the state statute in order to what is called a five-year update. And so five-year update to the original 1991 McLean County Integrated Solid Waste Management Plan. And so looking at all the changes that have happened and looking at the big change that's on the horizon, the McLean County landfill reaching capacity and beginning closure processes, we began to think that perhaps a five-year update wasn't really in the best interest of the community, that it maybe seemed kind of like a Band-Aid at this point.
How many times could you have updated the 1991 plan with five-year updates?
Technically, indefinitely. And so the state statute does not have any requirement for redoing the plan. However, our community is not the only one in the state of Illinois that is starting from scratch. It seems like there is, you know, a bit of a movement there that we all recognize that there is, you know, significant changes that have occurred since the 90s when we first all established our solid waste management plans.
So did you learn anything new from this public input process or the process over the last 2 years, or did it really just help reinforce some of what you already knew, where you thought this was going to go?
There was some of both. We now have a lot of good data in hand that really does help show, you know, very specifically the composition of our waste stream, how much of that is being landfilled that could be recovered. Some of that, honestly, was surprising to me about how much of that is recoverable that we are throwing away right now, the things that are recoverable even by kind of our existing facilities, but maybe not our existing systems, that we don't have good recovery processes, say, for multifamily housing recycling, even though those materials are perfectly recyclable. Likewise, commercial recycling. So the waste that most of our commercial businesses in Bloomington Normal generate are very similar in composition to what households generate as far as paper and containers and things that are easily recyclable.
How do you get to multifamily residence recycling? How do you get that done? We're talking about apartment buildings mainly.
The plan broadly identifies the needs and the gaps, and then some broad objectives as far as filling those gaps. What it doesn't go into is the very specific strategies, as we know that we need more stakeholder involvement to come to the final strategies that will be most effective in meeting the needs for our community. And so what we've theorized, for example, for multifamily housing, for apartments, that something like a system involving kind of a negotiated waste services by a neutral third party, such as the Ecology Action Center, where we put out to bid a geographically dense area of apartment buildings owned by multiple different companies. But the key is that it's geographically dense. And so we put out to bid for waste and recycling services, knowing that the more geographically dense route makes it more cost effective for the waste hauler. So they're able to gather more volume of materials in a shorter amount of time, less fuel, less labor, less wear and tear on vehicles, therefore making it more cost effective for the waste hauler. So can we pass along those savings to the rental companies, therefore keeping it cost neutral for them and for the tenants? So in the end, this is a win-win across the board.
Is it fair to call that a pilot program?
That would be a pilot program. So to explore the feasibility of making that happen, yes, we would look at pilot programs such as that and see, is that doable? Does that achieve what we hope it would?
And if the pilot program doesn't work or you can't find a company to participate in that in recovering those recyclables from multifamily dwellings, then do you think the municipalities would jump on board with an ordinance of some sort?
I think that there definitely is some discussion of that already, and so that's a good possibility, and it is even possible that those things go hand in hand. And so say even that pilot program works, but maybe the volume of materials is still not sufficient to make it terribly cost effective like we want to keep it cost neutral. And so can we then gain that volume and route density and enough participation to get those two variables up through an ordinance that does require recycling to be provided by rental companies?
What percentage of what ends up in the landfill is food waste that could be composted, and what has to happen to make a realistic dent in that particular stream?
Food scraps currently make up about 29,000 tons of the waste that we generate here in McLean County on an annual basis. Only about 10% of that is currently recovered. And so we're looking at 26,500 tons of food scraps that could easily be recycled, composted. And that produces, you know, good, valuable secondary products as far as compost. You can even look at advanced technologies such as anaerobic digestion, by which we can actually capture methane off the process as well and use it to generate electricity. That's a very good example of one of the waste streams that has some really good potential for economic stimulus, creating more jobs in our community.
But a lot of systems around that to make that actually happen.
Absolutely. But even those systems themselves, it's not really just a traditional waste management plan. This could be looked at as an economic development plan. We're at a turning point here in McLean County as we soon become kind of a post-landfill community. Do we wish to continue to follow the path of the status quo, to pay money to bury our waste in the ground, or do we wish to instead look at the composition of our waste stream and start to change our perception from looking at these materials as waste and instead look at these as resources for economic development? How much of this can we recover in actually a beneficial way?
So the goal isn't to be revenue neutral. It's to try to make money or to provide a better financial picture for the waste that we're currently burying.
At the very least, to be cost neutral, I think, is a very reasonable goal.
How do you do that if the markets for a lot of these recyclables is down?
The markets will fluctuate over time. However,
they're not going to be down for the next 20 years.
If they're down for the next 20 years, then there's something inherently wrong with this entire system that's been built so far and been fairly successful for the past few decades.
Commercial recycling, another gap. Can you give an example of some of the types of businesses and what are the obstacles to filling that gap?
We know that there's, you know, some businesses, it's a little hit or miss in our community as far as which ones recycle, which ones don't. I think those that do either really have a internal champion for the cause and really have taken, you know, extra steps to make sure it happens. Often we hear this is somebody who's taking recyclables home to make sure they get recycled. And that's not really a sustainable practice for most businesses.
So you're talking about everything from a shoe store to an office supply company to...
Exactly.
Any commercial business.
And I think one of the main barriers is looking at the bottom line. How much is this going to cost? And so, again, much like multifamily housing, you know, how can we facilitate this process? How can we help negotiate these services, especially in kind of geographically dense areas, uptown Normal, downtown Bloomington, business districts like that? How can we make this more cost effective for everybody so that it's not a burden on the business?
Construction and demolition waste is also a gap. Is that a hard sell to contractors?
I think that that's something that's definitely growing in its support. We've seen growth in the rate of how much construction demolition waste is being recycled in our community, but there's definitely potential for much more of that. So right now, our community generates about 53,000 tons of construction demolition waste every year. And as of 2014, only about 4% of that was being recovered. That number has increased in the past year as Bloomington Normal started sending their bulk waste, which is similar in composition, but their bulk curbside waste to the local C&D recycling facility. And so that number has gone up, but yet we know that there's huge potential to increase it even more.
Is it just a dollars and cents thing? Does a regular dumpster cost less than a dumpster that would go to a recycler?
That's part of it, and the actual dollars and cents is going to vary. So the gate rate that companies pay at the landfill actually varies a bit by the customer. Some that's, you know, subject to negotiation and maybe volumes of materials that customer brings. In some cases, we do know that the C&D recycling facility that exists here in our community can be cheaper than taking to landfill, but possibly for other customers, it's going to be cheaper to go to landfill.
Why a construction and demolition ordinance, but pilot programs for commercial and multifamily housing recycling?
The strategies that we would like to do pilot programs for those waste streams, as far as route densification and volume increase to make it more cost effective, those aren't things that we can change through voluntary measures for the C&D recycling, because route densification, so C&D materials,
they're intermittent
and they're all over. And so we can't densify that route. The volume, however, is what we can increase through an ordinance. And so bringing the volume up could potentially help bring the cost down as well.
What need do you think the Ecology Action Center has demonstrated for a permanent household hazardous waste facility with the response to every other year household hazardous waste drop-off events?
We are fairly unique in the state of Illinois in that we're one of the very few communities that still provides for the need of proper household hazardous waste disposal in the absence of regular state funding through this unique public-private partnership. It's been overwhelmingly successful. However, we know that despite all this huge support and huge visibility for this issue, huge understanding of the need for proper disposal, we're only reaching a small fraction of the community with the service because it's still not convenient. And so if we liken this to curbside recycling, and what we have right now, we've automated single-stream curbside recycling for most residents of Bloomington Normal. So that's really increased the participation in those programs. Participation has jumped up significantly, and that's what you see even in the new solid waste plan. We really aren't focusing on single-family housing and that recycling because that is very successful because we've met the need of reducing the barriers. We are not reducing the barriers enough for household hazardous waste. A permanent facility would do that. The more convenient we make it, the more likely people are going to take advantage of it.
And before 2027, this proposed plan calls for a process to establish an HHW facility. What does that take? What does it look like?
The next few years is to start working on a feasibility study for this future facility. We need to look at, you know, the actual needs of the community, and the community in this sense actually might be the broader community. It might be Central Illinois as a whole, given that there are no existing facilities yet. And so We're looking at the needs of McLean County first, but Central Illinois in the broader sense, and in some ways that can actually even help fund this facility. You know, do we make this a free service for our local residents, maybe donation-based voluntarily, but then we charge a fee to outside residents? And so the feasibility study would look at the volumes of materials, the cost to dispose of them, what sort of facility it needs to be, operating costs of that, but also how do we pay for this?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy talking with Ecology Action Center Executive Director Michael Brown about the community's next 20-year solid waste plan. Let's continue to talk about C&D, construction and demolition recycling, for a moment. Does that fall under recycling or also prevention and reduction, or even depending upon what you do with the C&D materials, energy recovery?
Sure. And so C&D recycling, as it happens right now, is largely actual recycling. There's some reuse in there as well, in that, and some of this is subject to the legal definitions of what is recycling and what is not. But most of it is recycling. Prevention and reduction, these are really bigger, more important strategies, but yet so much more difficult to implement kind of on the community level. And so source reduction, that's something that if we're looking at a industrial facility, there's been a lot of companies increasingly working towards what's called zero waste, where you are designing the waste out of your system, out of your processes, because waste is something that costs you money in the end. It's lost and wasted resources. And so they're designing it out, and that's done in a lot of cases by source reduction, in that they are intentionally designing their product so that it is the most effective usage of the raw materials to begin with, so there aren't scraps and things like that. And in the community scale, how do we design our community processes and behaviors to design the waste out? That is a matter of really retraining, you know, ourselves and our waste generation practices, you know,
and our consumer habits.
Exactly. Honestly, we're working against millions and millions of dollars of marketing from companies, from fast food, from other companies that are convenience-based, that are kind of telling us the opposite of what we need to be doing as far as source reduction.
How much longer will the McLean County landfill continue to accept solid waste?
That is a little bit of a moving target. It has been actually for years, as we've been watching the numbers kind of start to decline, and then the past few years decline more rapidly. So the most recent information I have from landfill officials is probably sometime in the first few months of 2018. However, that is subject to change. I mean, right now as it is, so Republic Services, also known as Allied Waste, do own and operate the McLean County Landfill, as well as Livingston County Landfill. And as it stands, as they accept waste at the McLean County Transfer Station, which is where the garbage trucks essentially dump their loads and it's filled into larger tandem trucks for transport into landfill. Those tandem trucks as well can take waste over to Livingston County at the discretion of Republic Services. So it's not really something that we as a community have complete control over. It is something that they may send waste over there on any given day. If, say, it's too wet, too muddy in McLean County landfills, it just makes more sense to send it there. So it's things like that there's these other variables that mean that lasts a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. We don't know.
What did the past solid waste plan do to lengthen the life of the McLean County landfill located on Bloomington's southwest side?
We mentioned earlier the curbside single stream automated recycling for residents of Bloomington Normal and some of the other communities in McLean County. So that's really helped increase participation. And while that in itself wasn't named as a strategy within the solid waste plan, as that didn't exist back when that was written, it is a solid waste plan that kind of helped drove that process towards increasing and improving our systems over time so that we would have things like that.
And presumably this plan, if implemented successfully, will add years to the next landfill McLean County's waste will end up, the Pontiac landfill in Livingston County. So we might see that landfill actually last longer as a result of what we do in McLean County.
That is correct. But is one way to interpret the proposed new 20-year solid waste management plan for McLean County as a transition over the 20 years so that we truly become a post-landfill community. So 20 years from now, 2037, how dependent will we be on traditional landfilling of our waste? If we follow this this plan to its logical conclusion, our dependence will be so reduced that landfill capacity will be, you know, pretty much a non-issue at that point.
What is the lifespan of the Pontiac landfill, presuming McLean County and other communities with similar solid waste plans are successful in implementing them?
We at least have a couple decades of life, of capacity left there. Honestly, a lot of the material going into Livingston County landfill is coming from Chicago. You can actually see the garbage trucks coming down. And our local contribution to that is not significant compared to some of the larger communities that send their waste there.
Is there any way to determine how much money this community has saved in tipping fees from by recycling and how much we might save in the future by recycling?
To look at how much we have saved, that's something we could come up with. We don't have the exact numbers on that, but definitely could come up with some estimates. Going forward, it's hard to project with any precision at this point.
I ask because sometimes it boils down to dollars and cents. Sometimes people, elected officials, aren't really concerned as much about the environment as they are about the bottom line.
Right. And you'll note even, you know, in all the strategies we're talking about so far, actually we haven't really talked about the environment. You know, that isn't really the driving factor here. What we're looking at is economic sustainability of our waste management practices. That is really the underlying value of this plan. Looking forward, you know, the rates that we will pay for landfilling waste over the next 20 years, it would be pure speculation. However, we can look at, you know, existing rates, say that Bloomington Normal pay per ton for disposal right now in their existing contracts, which is about $50 a ton. If we look nearby, Champaign County has not had a landfill since, I believe, the late 80s. So they are already a post-landfill community. City of Urbana pays about $100 per ton for their waste disposal. And so that's just one example of what's out there, what's possible in the future. That's not likely to happen right away. But at some point, yes, we're likely to be absorbing higher expenses if we don't take on more ambitious strategies to reduce the waste that we would be needing to landfill.
How will landfill and waste removal look in 2037? As this plan begins to age out, will we still recognize it?
If we follow this, what is truly a ambitious waste management plan, and look at attracting and developing services to meet these gaps in our community right now, to 2037, it kind of flips the pie chart in terms of our waste management strategy. Right now, looking at a pie chart of waste generated in McLean County, it is a sliver of that, you know, a little more than a quarter that currently is being recycled. And so in 2037, we have the potential to invert that. And so it is a sliver of that we are landfilling, and the vast majority of it is being recovered.
Michael, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas and for stopping by periodically to talk about these issues. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
After the county, city, and town approve the plan next month, the McLean County Solid Waste Plan will be submitted to the Illinois EPA on January 31st. This is Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Get up to speed on the Silver Ball fundraiser for Toys for Tots and the after show with the band Wildermore. That's still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. This opening has been part of Thursday nights on GLT for the past 16 years.
Hello, everybody from Tucson, Arizona. Let's get started with another Radio Munson.
Popular Bloomington Normal radio personality Don Munson will play one last song, then remove his headphones and turn off his microphone for the last time later this month in a final broadcast of his Radio Munson show. The 76-year-old broadcaster announced his upcoming retirement on November 30th.
We're on a very short leash here on the show. I've decided to pull the plug on Radio Munson after 16 years. on GLT, and I'll tell you, I've had a blast.
Munson spent nearly all of his 57-year broadcast career in Bloomington Normal. At one time, his morning show on WJBC garnered a larger audience share than any other similar program in a metropolitan area in the United States. Not long after he retired from JBC, Munson created a two-hour program for GLT that he often recorded from his winter home outside Tucson. Radio Munson showcased his favorite jazz tunes and music from the big band era and developed a loyal following. But in a Skype interview from Arizona, Munson tells GLT's Judy Valente that he wanted to leave his listeners on a high note.
Frankly, I'm not thinking as quickly as I once did. And as you know, when you ad-lib, you have to think fairly fast on your feet. And I've just noticed a little slowing down. And I want people to remember me before it was too late. I just feel it's time to move on. There's no special reason beyond that. I think it's, I'll be glad to have a little more free time. But the primary reason is just to get off the stage. It's time.
Will the show remain on the air in some form, perhaps in repeats?
We haven't talked about that. I'm a little reluctant to have that happen because the shows use the immediacy of radio. That is to say, I'll be talking about the current weather. I'll be saying it's, November 21st, and I'll be talking about the big football game coming up at Hancock Stadium this weekend. But yep, if a repeat show airs in May, when I'm saying all of those things, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It takes the spontaneity and the immediacy out of it. So I think maybe as podcasts, it might be a good thing that people can still access those. But I think we're probably done with the actual broadcasts on GLT.
This is your second retirement. You left WJBC in 2000 after 35 years. Many people who quote unquote retire go on to other careers or major projects. Is there any other project in the offing for Don Munson, something you'd like to do?
I don't have anything specific in mind. At some point, I've got all these, narrow reporters' notebooks that reporters all use. You probably have some yourself, a little spiral on the top, and they will actually fit in a pocket.
I do indeed.
And they're all filled up with notes. I might have to empty that notebook, all of those notebooks, at some point, and I'm not sure what form that'll take.
So we may be hearing from Don Munson in book form again.
Well, you never know.
You were so closely identified with WJBC for so many years as an on-air personality. Were you able to build that same kind of rapport with your GLT Radio Munson listeners?
I think so. I mean, it was less intimate than my broadcasts on WJBC because I was a morning personality then, and listeners invited me into their homes. In a day that not that many radios were in homes and maybe one TV set, but it was in the living room. So people, when they gathered around the breakfast table, one by one, two by two, maybe the whole family, the outside communication was the one radio that's in the kitchen. And Mom controlled that radio in most households. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, it was tuned to WJBC. So I really shared my family, with their families and vice versa. And to this day, I continue to hear from people who say, you were sort of the soundtrack of my growing up. And the GLT episodes, and now more than 16 years of them, have not been as intimate. I haven't been talking to other people on the air as I did quite frequently on JBC, but I have been able to do other things, and that is talk about the great artists that made this classic music that I love to play. So I don't think the two experiences were not similar in many ways, but each was rewarding to me in its own way. And I think maybe I did connect with GLT listeners who happen to share the love that I have for the kind of music that I play.
Well, you obviously have a special connection to the kind of music you play on Radio Munson, which would be big band, 30s, 40s, Las Vegas style music. Where did that interest come from?
It's the music I heard when I was growing up. The big bands were still around in the late 1940s and in the 1950s when I was growing up. Remember, I was born in 1941, so I really got interested in music probably as the 1950s started. And a Glenn Miller song, for instance, recording might be only, say, 5 years old at that time. So I was hearing that, and I was hearing a lot of these jazz arrangements of Broadway show tunes. There was just a raft of those through the 1950s and 1960s. I liked that, and that's what I was playing on the radio when I started in radio. My first broadcasts were in the fall of 1960s when I was a sophomore student down at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. And I transferred up to the University of Illinois, and I got my degree in journalism and communications in a couple of years later. And it's the music that I was playing there. When I came to WJBC, I wasn't playing music. I was a newsman, and I did some sports reporting and play-by-play for a couple of years in the late 1960s. But after I'd been at JBC for a few years, they asked me to do the morning show, and I did. And so I was playing mostly music that I had grown up listening to. The very music, the music I still play on Radio Munson.
You obviously enjoy playing music. Do you play any instruments yourself? And if so, what instruments?
No, I'm not a musician in any shape or form. I just love good music. And I'll throw around musical terms from time to time and always wonder if I'm getting it right. You know, every once in a great while, somebody will straighten me out. My guess is that I make more mistakes than I'm hearing about.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. We're talking with Don Munson from Radio Munson on GLT, whose last show will be December 28th. When you were on the air on WJBC every weekday, you had the area's largest audience by far, but you used that as a platform to build community understanding and promote causes you thought would make this a better community. Is there one effort that you're most proud of from those years?
The one I've most recently thought about, a thing that JBC helped organize, the event was the Welcome Home Parade that Bloomington Normal gave veterans of Vietnam and of Korea, the Korean War as well, a long time after they all had come home to a shrug of the shoulders at best, and ugly signs and shouted epithets at worst. And it was a wonderful parade that went from Bloomington up to Normal. The towns turned out, and a lot of tears were shed that day. I just felt that was maybe the best thing that JBC was ever involved in. And a lot of vets remember that today.
Don, what was your most memorable moment on radio?
I'm not sure I have one. I mean, I remember, you know, occasional embarrassments. I remember when I referred to a town in Southern California as La Jolla, California. And then I guess I started a record or a commercial or something, and the phone rang almost immediately, and it was ringing off the hook. People telling me, Don, that's La Jolla. Come on. And there are just numerous instances where I just stepped my foot into it. And the good moments, the positive moments were just so many. You know, I've talked about people I've interviewed, and I guess a memorable interview was the great Duke Ellington. He was coming to Bloomington to perform, and I was at the concert before a less than full house at what now is called the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. You know, the place only holds like 12 or 1300 people, and it was a midweek concert. It was the most famous jazz band in the land.
Right.
This would have been in the early 1970s, and the place was maybe two-thirds full, maybe a half full. It just amazed me. But having interviewed Duke just prior to that was an interview highlight of my life.
What do you think is lacking in radio today? What kinds of shows would you like to see more of?
This may sound a little narrow here, but I would like to see more shows like those that are on GLT. That is to say, I would like to see more shows that try to get people of varying viewpoints talking to each other and to hosts without raising their voices. It's hard to find programs like that anymore. I find a number of them on GLT and other NPR stations. I think musically, people get their music from so many different places anymore that I'm just not sure what's going to happen to what I knew as commercial radio. I mean, there's, you know, there are good things still happening on commercial radio, but the audiences are now so fragmented. People have so many different choices now, not just on radio stations, but of their devices and music that they can get online or from Pandora or whatever their choice of music is. And or listening to their own libraries, which I often do when I'm out walking. I'm not listening to any radio sometimes, just my own music. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with that great combination of radio and music. But I do think radio still has a place because it is so mobile. Radio goes with you wherever you go. And I would like to see more serious news. And again, there are some economics involved there that make that very difficult.
In your career, there was a time when the dominant media in McLean County, like the Pantograph and WJBC, were essentially owned by the same family. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? Or are we better served by the wide variety and multitude of media available to us today?
I think we're better served in many ways, at least, by the diversification of ownership that the FCC has allowed. But we're also limited by that very same thing, because what's happened is large corporations whose owners are shareholders and who are not necessarily interested in one little radio station in Bloomington, Illinois, are calling all of the shots now. So we have radio stations or companies that own, 500, even 1,000 radio stations. But the newspapers and radio stations being separated, I think, is a good thing. And the possibility that may be possible again through FCC rulings that are rumored to be in the works, that is, a radio station can be owned by a newspaper, I think that sets up a situation where instead of two reporters covering an issue, maybe a city council meeting, for the one for the radio station, one for the newspaper, it can be done with one reporter. So there's one interpretation of what went on. And it happens to result in a story in the newspaper, and it happens to result in a story on the radio station by the same reporter. I prefer to have two reporters, one from each entity, at those meetings. And that's a strong argument for keeping newspapers and radio stations, and for that matter, radio stations and TV stations, under separate ownership.
Speaking of reporters, what advice would you give to a young person today who wants to have a career in broadcast?
Well, as far as news reporting and broadcasts, I would say leave your opinions at the door. That is the door when you walk into work each day. And I think that's still done, mostly. Those of us who listen to the news, watch the news, read the news, have biases. So do the very reporters who cover the news. But that doesn't mean they can't be fair. Listen to the facts. Make sure that if there are two sides of an issue, make sure that they're represented. They don't have to be represented equally, but they should be represented. And I find that we've drifted away a little bit from that. And we've also drifted away from the idea of reporters are reporters and pundits are pundits. Now we see reporters whose opinions come through in the interviews they give when they appear on these pundit shows on the cable TV channels.
Don, you live pretty much full time in Arizona now. Will there be some way that you'll be keeping up ties with Bloomington Normal now that Radio Munson will be going off the air?
We'll never leave Bloomington Normal. And we spend about half a year in Arizona and half a year in Bloomington Normal. So Bloomington Normal is home. I love Bloomington Normal. I love Central Illinois. I love the people. And they've just given me such a good life. I can't see ever leaving it for good.
Legendary broadcaster Don Munson talking with GLT's Judy Valente. Here's Munson signing off for the last time from his WJBC morning show in 2000.
I'd become such a part of so many people's lives, generations of people in some households, and I only got it through my thick skull here in recent years how much all of you have become a part of my life.
Tune in to GLT Thursday evening, December 28th, to hear the farewell program of Radio Munson on GLT. Pocket, Count Basie and his orchestra on GLT's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council, hosting Be In By The Numbers, a quarterly update on McLean County's economic progress on Thursday, December 14th, at Illinois State University's Bone Student Center Prairie Room from 11:30 to 1. More information at bnbiz.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. The after party for this year's Silver Ball at the Castle Theater Saturday night will be just across the alley at Diggers, featuring Wildermore playing songs by The Who. The Bloomington-based quartet says diving into that band's catalog has given them a deeper appreciation for song structure and the technical abilities of The Who. Wildermore's Aaron Wismiller, Zach Hoffman, and Dave Gildenar joined GLT's John Norton in the studios. Wismiller said the British invasion theme of the Toys for Tots fundraiser made choosing a band to cover easy, as the Beatles and the Stones were already being covered at the main show.
And so the logical next band is The Who.
And it's the after party for the Silver Ball and The Who song, Pinball Wizard. First lines, ever since I was a young boy, I played the Silver Ball. So it's just like,
Didn't even hit me.
We have to do The Who. Plus there's some Silver Balls up there, too.
Who thought about that?
Where did that come from? Aaron? Yeah.
No.
Dave? We had already chosen The Who, and then later that night, my brother was like, this line exists, and it's like,
Have you guys been fans of The Who for a long, long time as well?
Oh,
because here's the Beatles, there's the Stones, and there is The Who, but the Beatles and Stones are in this rarefied air, right? And then there's The Who.
We've talked about that. I don't know that we have an answer for it, really, but we have talked about that, how it's like this kind of holy trinity, but there's a clear two of them are much more better known than the other.
Yeah, you
know?
There is a demarcation there.
Mm-hmm. They were
this
just
is,
a little
this
too,
is Zach now, by the way.
Too rambunctious, I think, to be real popular like the Beatles. They were causing way too much trouble in the hotels. And
well, they were doing that.
Yeah.
Well, the question I want to ask is what do you think they brought to the table? I mean, the Beatles brought so much. The Beatles are the Beatles, but they changed a lot of things in America, right? I mean, from hairstyles to the way people talk to even movie making, right? I mean, they were doing great movies back then. What the Stones brought
blues, right? The Beatles brought pop, and the Who
Stones brought attitude
rock.
As well.
Rock, yeah, I mean, like, yeah. That's the thing that I've grown to appreciate doing this more than anything is just realizing how much of rock music came from the Who more than these other two bands. I mean, it's the fundamentals of all the kind of heavier rock that took place from the 70s on.
Can you draw a line from The Who to somebody later or even today?
I think you could draw a funnel and put, you know, seriously, put everything, you know. I mean, there's a lot of bands that have stolen licks directly from The Who or, you know, song format and just that kind of rock and roll spirit. I mean, The Who embodied that more than... They were kind of first at that, I feel. You know?
And like the live, on-stage, raucous persona, just out of control, smashing stuff.
The first thing that comes to mind is Mars Volta swinging that microphone around, Roger Daltrey used
to.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
We're talking with guys from Wildermore. They're playing the after party of the Silver Ball fundraiser. It's a Toys for Tots fundraiser Saturday night. The fundraiser's at the Castle Theater. They're playing Diggers afterwards. I want to ask you about Diggers specifically in just a bit, too. When I had the guys from Jacked Up and the Empty Bottles in here the other day, they're playing Beatles covers, and I asked them about their set list. Was it hard to figure out a set list? And basically they said they just knuckled it out, knock down, drag out on who's going to play what and what songs. How did you guys choose your set list? There's a lot of songs to choose from.
Yeah, we went through all the albums, everybody's favorite songs, and, we had to cut a lot of them that we really like.
There were some that we just kind of refused to cut, though, as far as the big rock Who songs.
Yeah. I mean, you got to do Tommy, right? he's giving me this really painful look.
We do a lot of songs from Tommy, but
you didn't do Tommy.
We aren't.
I don't know. There's no like.
Won't get fooled
Tommy
again.
Song,
but
won't get
course.
Fooled again.
My generation.
Yeah. Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Pinball Wizard. Yeah. I guess the big
Who
one.
Who are
Tommy.
You?
I'm free.
Yeah. Well, how about? Can you play a song right now? Can we get you to play something? Give us a little taste of what we might hear at Diggers on Saturday night yeah. into okay. Sunday morning. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm assuming you're going to be plugged in at Diggers on Saturday night?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
All I'll right. have a whole drum kit there. Yeah.
the Who would not be the Who without a big drum kit.
And a wall of speakers. You going to have that as well?
We can't afford their setup. But, you know, relative to the size of Diggers, it's about the right scale.
Okay. All right. Aaron Wissmiller, Zach Hoffman, and Dave Gildenhar. Are with us. They're Wildermore. They're going to be playing songs from The Who at Diggers on Saturday night into Sunday morning. It's the after party for the Silver Ball fundraiser. Castle Theater gets a lot of credit. We had a story on our air about the revival of the Bloomington Normal music scene. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're national acts that come through for the most part. I know some local acts play there as well. But for the most part, from what I hear from people, Diggers seems to be, maybe it's overstating, almost ground zero for local people. This is where you go to have fun and play, and everybody gets to play there. I mean, I know there's six strings, there's jazz up front, there's soon to be the night shop, and, you know, there's going to be places. What is Diggers?
I think Diggers benefits from two things. One, proximity to the castle.
Uh-huh.
The fact that they're literally right across the alley makes just location, right? But also, it's got a cool vibe. It's a music bar. There's albums all over the wall. It's a place, you know, it's a cool music place. And they have pretty good beer for cheap, too, so I think that really helps them out.
Well, it seems to be a local gathering place, too, where locals just go.
It's a townie bar, for sure.
Yeah, definitely townie.
Okay. Well, let's give you some props for the band that you normally play with Wildermore. You're doing jazz rock. Am I doing that right? How would you describe it, then?
Ooh.
Aaron's kind of shaking his head. A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
It is a lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it more like Ink Trail than The Who? Or
no,
what?
I mean, I don't think we do any standards like Ink Trail does. I mean, I know we don't do any standards like Ink Trail does. We kind of don't do anything like Ink Trail does. They're pretty awesome. They're kind of the...
Who's the Tommy O'Donnell of Wildermore?
That'd be Dave. No, I mean, I think what makes Wildermore... what I enjoy most about it as a band is that we are all very diverse fans of music. We all like a lot of different kind of music. I kind of joke that you cannot sing a song in this band and be made fun of. I don't care what it is. We just did a show a couple weeks ago at McGuire's with Flaccid, and after the show, what song was that popped in my head? We're sitting out in my car, and this stuff popped in my head, this dorky 80s like pop song, and I turned it up on Spotify, and we were all in my car sitting there singing it together. And I was just like, what other band is doing this after?
Some Stevie Wonder.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
No, that was second. It was worse before that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not ashamed of this.
Thing is guilty pleasures.
Yeah, but we all have big diverse tastes in music. We all like a lot of different kind of music, and I think that a lot of that shows up in what we do. It is kind of hard to define a genre of it. But, I mean, it's definitely rock music. There's a lot of energy to it. Sometimes it's really heavy, but sometimes it's more kind of funky or jazzy. You know, I mean, it just goes all over.
Dave or Zach, either one of you dive in. What has diving into all these Who songs, how has it made you a better musician? How has it changed how you look at the Who? How has it impacted you?
I know I always kind of thought Zach, Keith Moon was just a crazy, crazy guy on the drums. And I'm kind of impressed with his drumming these days because, he was crazy, but he could focus that into some awesome energy that just drove this band. I mean...
Cold fusion.
Yeah. The guy kicks butt. I mean.
Well, that's Zach. How about you, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, learning all these songs just blows my mind the way Pete Townsend, he's just freaking genius, the way he makes these chords and the melodies that he puts over these simple chords. A lot of the songs share similar, like, theory, you know, music theory, but they don't sound alike at all. And he always has these really awesome, like, mellow parts in the song and just very progressive and... There was a lot of other stuff going on at the time when he was writing this, and really inspiring, like, as a songwriter.
Giving you a new appreciation for the band, even?
Oh, for sure.
All three of you?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Cool.
100%. For sure.
Well, thanks for coming in, and it's great that you're doing this on Saturday night. One more song. Can you guys do one more?
I just have to point out, John Morton, that this song requires a pick. And I am using a GLT logoed guitar pick from a show about 5 years ago.
Very proud. Cool.
Aaron Westmiller, Zach Hoffman, and Dave Gildenar of Bloomington-based Wildermore speaking with GLT's John Norton. Substitute is one of the Who songs they'll cover at the Silver Ball after party at Diggers this Saturday night. The Silver Ball is a fundraiser for McLean County Toys for Tots with a British invasion theme this year. Jack Dupp and the Empty Bottles will cover Beatles songs, and the Steepwater Band will cover Rolling Stone songs at the Castle Theater beginning at 7 p.m. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Judy Valente and John Norton. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. We want you to tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.